This is Lawrence Hillman, 16 November 2005, Archetypal Astrology.
I'm delighted that you're all here, and I have a lot I want to talk about tonight. I realize that the title that I suggested to you all is quite presumptuous, 21st Century Language of Healing, and I hope to do justice to that title tonight by offering you a few insights that come mainly from my practice. I really am what I would like to call a practicing astrologer. I do this full time. I talk to people all over the world. I do them in three languages, and I talk mostly on the phone. Of course, in St. Louis, I see people in face to face, but mostly readings are done online. By the phone. And so I really bring to astrology a as Connie said, a therapeutic approach. In other words, it's a tool to help people find more about why they're here or what their situation is. A lot of people come in deep crisis. Some people come just because they're curious. There's no typical client. I see all kinds of people. There are lots of professionals, I have priests, psychiatrists, I have, religious Jews, I have religious Christians, I have religious Hindus. There's no typical person. Everybody is interested in astrology across the board. So there's no one kind of person who typically would come and see me. And I say that because that's why I think it's a universal language. It does speak to most people. So what I'd like to do, I'm also very interested in the theater. I've been fortunate enough to do two workshops at the Globe Theater in London. And it has really stimulated my imagination to actually stand on that stage. I don't know if you know about it, the round donut, and then the stage is in the middle. It's under open sky. It has a thatched roof in the middle of 21st century London. And we spent the night sleeping on the stage, which was pretty cool. The heavens on the stage are painted with the zodiac. And everybody chose their sign and slept under it. It was really pretty cool. So, because you were sleeping here and then you were looking out under the real stars, the real sky. So I want to start with the theater metaphor, which is the one that I use when I teach astrology, when I talk about it. And I do this also with my clients, but it's an easy way to quickly get into a very complicated language. I realize that there are some people in here who are professional astrologers, or almost, and there are some people here who know absolutely nothing. So I'm going to approach it in a way that I hope speaks to everybody and doesn't leave anybody out. I'm not speaking over anybody and not below anybody, but directly to, hopefully, all of you. If you can start imagining a large, round stage. Shakespeare said that all the world's a stage. So we'll start with that literal image. And on this stage, we have 10 actors. And they walk around the perimeter of the stage at different speeds. The first one, the fastest one, the moon. By the way, in astrology, you call the sun and the moon planets. It's a convention. So we talk about 10 planets. If you want to talk about the 11th planet, all those things we can later. I'm sticking now to traditional 10 planet ideas that are astrological. So we have these 10 actors. They're walking around at different speeds. The fastest one, the moon, takes about 28 days to go around that stage once. We're familiar with that cycle from full moon to full moon. Most of us have that in our system somehow innately. The slowest one, Pluto, takes 248 years to do the same trip. So there's a huge difference in speed, and they're all moving around the edge of the stage as actors. Imagine them as literal as characters. So they're moving all the time, but at the moment of, let's say, your birth, any chart that I want to look at, I tell all these actors, freeze where you are. And then I climb up above the stage into the rigging with my camera, and I take a snapshot of this stage, and I plot that picture onto a circle. That's a chart. That's it. It's 10 actors. Of course, they're not actors. They're planets in the sky. They're reflected on the stage, but it's easier to think of them as characters. It is human nature to talk about ourselves as being made up of different parts. How many times have you said, a part of me would like to do this, but another part of me is telling me don't do that, or I'm torn inside? It doesn't mean we're schizophrenic. We actually do think that way. We think of ourselves as being made up of different people inside. We're peopled. Jung talked about archetypes. There's an anima inside. There's an animus inside. It's just another way of saying it. Modern, if you want to call them that, but other psychologists talk about, the inner child or the inner this or the inner that. That's another way of peopling us with characters inside. But usually we just say a part of me. The Greeks actually talked about the gods within, another way sort of speaking that language. And I just call them the planets. There's different parts. So when I say I've put their names on there and sort of their main functions, as a way, that's sort of the first language. I also do this because most people know their sun sign. And they say, I'm an Aries, I'm a Cancer, tell me something about me. And it's like, well, are you, you know, it's like saying someone's a redhead. That says maybe certain things about the person. Maybe they're more feisty than others. Maybe they're, you know, something, whatever. People have these sort of images. But it's an extremely limited description of a person. Similarly to an astrologer, when you hear someone say, I'm a Cancer, it's you cringe because it's that limited. It's almost like saying, I'm an introvert. That doesn't say a lot about you. It says a few things, perhaps. So most of us know the sun sign that we're in. That's the sun. That's one of the actors. I don't care about the signs nearly as much as I care about the planets. The planets are the active parts of us. Planet comes from the Greek, and it means the wanderers. They are the wanderers in the sky, and they're the characters within us that we take on. And this is an important part. Anybody know the term animus ridden? Animus ridden basically means somebody who steps into this very martial, sort of aggressive kind of way of behaving, was one of Jung's terms. You say somebody's animus ridden if they're in your face, they're angry, they're aggressive, they're sort of, they can be that as a character trait also. So in that term of thinking, we step into any of these 10 characters at certain times in our lives. It is hardwired in us. These are archetypes. When anyone falls in love, and I say anyone, if they're in southern Egypt or northern Alaska, the behaviors are extremely similar. You get giddy, you see everything through, you know, pink glasses. You start giggling a lot, you know, you long for your other one, you want to smell them, you want to see them, all these things. That's a universal archetypal thing, okay? If you want to see how an archetype can take over a person, if anybody was watching Tom Cruise this spring, that to me is a classic. If you didn't see it, Tom Cruise fell in love with Katie Holmes, another actor, and was on television behaving absolutely, totally ridiculous, jumping up and down on sofas and screaming and shouting, declaring his love to her. This is what happens when you step into an archetype fully. He stepped into the archetype of Venus fully. Every cell of your body becomes that when you do it. Mars, the god of war, if you're in a dark alley at 2 o'clock in the morning, someone jumps out of a shadow and attacks you, you become Mars in every fiber of your body. It's not a choice. It's fight or flight, however your Mars is wired. How your Mars is wired is something we're going to look at, the different kinds of Mars that they are. But it's still the archetype Mars. So everybody will respond from that point and become that. Some people's Mars may be very forgiving and sort of backtracking. Hey, please don't hurt me. I'm fine. I got kids, whatever. And other people will go into a fighting stance. That depends on how your Mars is. But when you're threatened, Mars kicks in. So these archetypes take over our lives at certain times, or we step into them, or they step into us, depending on your viewpoint. That's the first kind of sort of understanding of how it happens within life. But these characters are not alone on the stage. There's 10 of these on the stage, and of course, they are actually interacting. And now we're coming to the second level of astrology. The first one are the planets, and the second one are what are called, and there are only 4. If you understand these 4, I'm going to explain in the next period of time, you will have pretty much understood all of astrology. It's really that simple if you can break it down into these 4 things, if you really understand them. First one is the planets. That's the most crucial one. They're alive. They're in us. We step into them. And some people, you feel them. Some people are the archetype, you know, in toto. If I see somebody who's completely, you know, goth, let's say, black and face jewelry and, you know, and painted and whatnot, that's an impersonation of an archetype to me. I see archetypes everywhere. Of course, nobody is purely one archetype. We're mixed with all kinds of different, because again, there are relationships, and that's where we get to now. The interrelationships, the interactions, we go back to the word actor, action. The interaction between the planets are called aspects, which comes from the Latin aspectare, which means to look at. These planets are seeing each other on the stage. As you probably know, a look can mean a lot. If you're in a jail and you're walking down the hallway and you look at somebody the wrong way, you get a knife between you or a toothbrush between your ribs. You can fall in love with someone across the room. A look is a very powerful thing. So how the planets are seeing each other is also an important thing. And in astrology, the way we figure that out, well, how do 2 planets see each other, is simply as, and this is the part that gets some people confused, but let's say we have Venus here and we have Mars here. These are 2 of the actors. We measure the angle between them. Any 2 points on a circle make up an angle. This is not a right angle, it's an angle, okay? certain angles mean certain things. You do not have to understand this, except know that there's ways in astrology to measure how two of these characters see each other. We can separate them into, in a friendly way, and into a tensional way. Much like relationships, sort of like two planets instantly like each other, or two planets are instantly sort of at odds. Not good or bad. Not good or bad. I think the hard aspects, as they're called, the ones that have to do with difficulty, are much more interesting, and if you want to use good or bad, much better, even though they're more difficult. But they're the creative aspects. They're the ones that get people out of bed in the morning, and I'll talk about that a little more later. So, we have a friendly way to see each other and a tensional way to see each other. There's also a mixture. There could also be two planets that are... What if these two planets happened to be exactly in the same place in the sky? Let's say there was a planet right here, and they were both exactly there. Let's say on a stage, they're taking up the same square foot of space. That's possible. They can be in the same place in the sky. It's called an alignment. If two planets are exactly in the same space, imagine you two are sharing that chair. Okay? That's kind of what it's like. Again, let's think really practically as actors on a stage. What happens if you two share a chair? First of all, it would matter who you are. If one of you is a Republican and one's a Democrat and you're discussing politics, it's probably going to be ugly. But if one's a dancer and one's a painter and you're discussing the arts, it works fine. So one of the things we have to do is understand who the characters are that are interacting in this way. So we want to know who they are. But when they share a space, they're also kind of tied together like a three-legged race. Those two are literally in the same spot. So you can't separate these two. If you have two planets in the same place, that's a part of you that is so close, it's like two guys or two women or a guy and a woman standing like this next to each other, and they are always together. It's a three-legged race. Each step that one takes, the other one has to take. We have to take that into consideration when we look at a chart. So now we have two things. We have actors and interaction. Now come the signs. And the signs is the backdrop in astronomy. We just want to look at astronomy quickly. There's the sun in the middle, all the planets go around, and then way further away are the fixed stars. So if you're standing on the Earth and you're looking at any planet, it appears in front of some fixed stars. The star constellations, the stars actually, the planets always appear within a belt. It's called the zodiac belt. And we cut that into 12 pieces, and then the planet is in front of one of those 12. And that would be the sun signs that you know, the signs of the zodiac. So that's what this... basically cutting the backdrop, if you want, or the edge of the stage into 12 pieces. And there's a system to how that's done and all that stuff you don't have to know, but I'm just going to mark them here real quick because we might, to give you some sense. Okay, there's the 12 signs of the zodiac. So, for instance, let's say your sun is here. When you're born, this is the sign of Aries. Your sun is now in Aries, and you walk around telling everybody you're in Aries. Okay? But now you can start to see how limited that is, because if somebody has, let's say, their sun in Aries, and they have six planets over here in Scorpio, they are much more of a Scorpio than a Aries. So it's really not accurate to ever talk about anybody in any context without knowing the whole chart, because it is a limited view. Certain things are true, like I said about the redhead. Maybe there's some truth to that. I don't have enough experience to say that. But maybe there's some truth to that, that all whatevers are a certain way. But it's very limited. That would make us 12 kinds of people. So the sign that the planets are in, how does that affect the planet? I look at the signs, back to the theater metaphor, as the clothes that the actors are wearing. It changes us a lot, what we wear. Let's take Venus. The part of us that represents beauty, relationships, intimacy, also sex, money, chocolate, sweetness, beauty, all those things that most people want. Okay, Venus, by the way, she also represents backstabbing, intrigues, gossip, and all that stuff also belongs to Venus. There's no good planets and bad planets. Every planet has its shadow side or a flip side to it. And tomorrow we'll get into that much more. We actually look at our planets in our charts and talk about that a little bit more. So again, there's no good or bad in astrology. It depends how you live out a planet. And we'll get to the issue of free will, which is huge here. So, let's take Venus, and let's just give some examples. Let's say Venus is in the sign of Pisces over here. If Venus is in the sign of Pisces, she may appear on that stage that we're imagining wearing long flowing gowns and has flowers in her hair and offers you a glass of wine. That would be sort of Venus in the Pisces. That's how she would be dressed. If she were in Capricorn, she might be wearing a business suit and have a briefcase in her hand and Wall Street Journal in the other. Same actor. If she's in Scorpio, maybe she's wearing 4-inch heels and leather and is holding a whip. Okay? Same actor. Now, just as you would feel different if you're wearing a party dress or your nightshirt and you behave differently, the actors are modified by the signs that they're in. So think of the signs as the modifiers, is another way to call them. And we get a deeper sense now. We're getting somewhere now. We're not talking sun signs anymore. Now we have 10 actors interacting in 12 possible signs. Now we have many, many more possibilities already. Now we're going to make it one more level of complication or sophistication, depending on how you look at it. And that's by taking this pie here and cutting it into 12 slices. Slices of pizza, if you want, or you can play with that word and call it slices of life. And that's literally what I'm going to do. I'm going to take this pie and I'm going to cut it into 12 pieces. Like this. These sections, or slices or segments, are called astrologically houses. You've probably heard I have, you know, the sun in the fifth house or something like that. Some of you might have heard that. You all remember When the Moon is in the Seventh House, Aquarius song? Okay, now you know what that means. Moon over here, seventh house. Because we start here with, this is zero or one. The first house goes from here to here. And it's counterclockwise. So the seventh house is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. When the moon is in the seventh house meant that, in this song, the moon was in the seventh house. That's what they're talking about. So the houses have to do with areas of life where things happen. Now is the time to start imagining props. So in one area of the stage, in one of these slices of life, we have, let's say, a little vault. This part of your life talks about money. It's where the money happens. Then we have a place where there's a bed. That part talks about your sex life. Then there's a part where there's maybe a desk or a massage table or an operating table, whatever you do. And that part talks about your work. Now we're getting pretty sophisticated. Now we have actors dressed a certain way, dressed in a certain way, and now we also can start finding out where in your life are they really busy. So let's say this is the house of the sort of the I am, the me, sort of the most selfish, unevolved, but very directly me, what I see in the mirror, how people see me, that part of our life, also our sort of physical appearance, physical health, those kind of things, that part of your life. If you have a lot of planets there, a lot of actors busy in that part of your life, you're going to spend a lot of time in your life looking in the mirror and caring about yourself and doing self-help courses and learning about yourself, and really you're interested in me, because that's where a lot of the energy is happening. You start to see how it plays out. It's very simple once you get these four steps. There's nothing more. That's it. There are a million techniques and there's lots of, you know, little tricks and specialty things, but that's really it. If you get those four things, you've got astrology. That's it. Now, there's lots of keywords you need to learn and things like that. I have a cheat sheet on my website you can download. I'll put my website up here that has all of it on one page. So I tell my students, if you can memorize that page, you know 80% of astrology. It's a lot to memorize, but it's... So you can feel free to get yourself a cheat sheet on the front page. That's an L there. Get yourself a cheat sheet.
You might want to say that into the tape for the purpose of the people who have to pay.
lhillman.com. www.lhillman.com. So, I'm just saying, I'm trying to simplify it because I know I've taught a lot of people and I know how people get overwhelmed so quickly with this idea and all the math and the notions and all that stuff. You don't have to do the math anymore because it's now done on computers. I used to do it by hand. It took me 4 hours to do a chart with the logarithm tables and all that kind of stuff. And I've gone back and looked at some of the old charts. A lot of them are wrong because you just make mathematical errors. And now it's, you know, split second. You can do research. It's so much more fun. So you can get free charts online. The whole mathematical part has been taken out of the equation. I still make my students who are really serious learn the math because I think you have to know what you're doing. Or the garbage in, garbage out kind of thing. You have to have a sense that there are some rules. For instance, if the sun is here, it's impossible to be born at midnight. You have to know these kind of things. So that you can, if you have a time and you look at your chart and they don't match, that jumps out at you. And you don't have to understand why that is, but there's just some things like that. So anyway, so having said that, we now have the four actors. Now, I mean the four levels of astrology. And I also mentioned them in the order of importance. The planets are by far the most important. I don't start with the signs. The planets are the important parts. They're the archetypes, the moving parts, if you want, the wanderers. They're alive. The signs are dead. They're fixed stars in the background. So that's a shift I hope you all make tonight, at least if you're interested in this kind of thinking. So then you start asking the question, okay, well, how do you enter a chart? It's complicated. You can look at it. I have some charts here. You can look at them. There's a lot going on, and it's overwhelming sometimes. I like to start not with the sun and the moon, which is sort of the classic way, but I like to look at, again, we're talking about a stage here. Imagine yourself sitting in a real theater, looking up at a stage, and on one side of the stage you have two actors kissing, or more if you want, and on the other side of the stage you have two actors engaged in a sword fight drawing blood. Okay. It is human nature to look at the fight first. Any tabloid news editor will tell you sex comes a close second, but if it bleeds, it leads. Okay? So it's human nature. Now, some people, well, I don't like to be violent. And it's not. The bottom line is that's where we look first. Maybe it's self-protection. I don't know why, but, you know, good news doesn't sell. They'll tell you that. So there's something about we're drawn to that. Let's just accept that for a second. So if we're really drawn to that tension, think of tension as making noise. There's a way to find out amongst all these relationships between all these planets, and there can be lots, there can be 20. There's a way to find out which is the most intense. And it has to do with degrees and numbers, you don't have to understand that. But once you know, therefore you can actually rank them, the relationships, by intensity. So the first thing I look at when I look at a chart is where is the closest tension between two actors. This is so typically what Jung might have called a complex, or so typically what I think of as a thorn in your foot. Every step of the way of your life, any path you take, unless you learn how to fly, you're gonna be dealing with that thorn in your foot. Some people pull it out, some people grow, you know, thick skin around it, some people buy Dr. Scholl's Band-Aid. There's different ways to deal with a thorn, but you have to deal with a thorn because it hurts, and you have to figure out how to do that. So the biggest noise is really something that immediately starts to give you a very good sense about the person's inner life, because that's where there's a lot of clashing and banging. There can be all these wonderful things going on. Think of these 10 actors as kids for a moment. You know, you got two kids pulling their hair, pulling each other's hair and hitting each other in the corner. It doesn't matter if you've got 8 other nice kids sitting here waiting for a story. That's going to disrupt everything. And that's what you see again and again. People come in, and, you know, everything's going great in their life, except over here, things constantly mess up for the last 25 years. And you see exactly that theme. I'll give you an example of a theme. Let's pick one. Moon, Neptune. Moon and Neptune together. These are signatures, what are called signatures in astrology. It means certain things. There's no one true way to read any Moon-Neptune relationship. But I'll give you some typical ones that I've seen doing this for a while, and that are sort of known and common. Moon-Neptune, the moon represents the part on your stage that feels, how you feel about things, your emotions. It's the mother archetype in the big sense. It's the embrace, it's the breasts, it's the chicken soup, it's the come and I'll hold you, it's all those kind of things. That's the moon. It's the mother upstream, as in your mother, it's mothering, as in downstream. Remember, every person has all 10 archetypes. That's one of the reasons I like astrology, because it's not non-discriminatory through the sexes. Every man has a moon and every woman has a Mars. Everybody has all 10 planets. So, how a person relates to the mother is shown by the moon. And so, Neptune is the part of us that I like to think of as a little fog machine in a canister on your back, in your backpack. And it has a little hose that goes here. And every time you step into the area of your chart where Neptune is, which is in one of, everybody has it somewhere, this is equal opportunity, that part of your life becomes foggy. Let's say you have it in the money area, okay? Someone has Neptune here, this house here, the second house talks about money. And I'm simplifying here. There's more to it than that, but let's just say that. This is the area, this is where the vault would be. This is about money. If you have Neptune here, your life can be totally wonderful. You can have everything totally in order. But whenever it comes to money, it's really confusing. That part of life just never makes sense. You know the joke, what do you mean I have no more money, I still have checks? That was written by someone who has Neptune in the second, or for someone. It's a confusing part of your life. It's also where you're the most inspired. Remember, no good or bad planets? This could be somebody who just sort of floats and money comes to them from somewhere. You know, that sort of the whole idea of manifesting your wealth really would work for someone with Neptune in the second. So, now we have a little bit of a sense of Neptune is the dreamer in us. It is the part that makes us evaporate, is the part that is the most gullible, is the part that is the most spiritual, is the part that's most connected to this fine diaphanous line between quote-unquote reality and whatever is beyond reality. I'm talking about Earth now versus, let's say, fog or mist, depending on your preference. And when Neptune and the Moon line up, you start to get a sense. I'm sure by now you can start feeling a little bit that your feelings might be a little bit confusing to you. There may also be a very strong emotional need to step out of reality. It's one of the classic signatures for addiction. Of course, because this is somebody who wants to constantly go bye-bye or go to Nana Land. I call you know, drugs and alcohol and those things, I call them Neptune candy because they're so, you know, enticing. Because that's what, because Neptune wants you to go there. But there's lots of other ways to go there too. The easiest way is to, you know, shoot up or smoke something or drink something. That's sort of the quick way to get to Neptune. But it's the same thing. So someone with a strong Neptune-Moon situation where there's tension, let's say, between them, is very prone to some kind of addiction. Now, why would I say that? Because that's just one of the expressions of a Moon-Neptune. Because it can also be someone who's extremely psychic, you can sense the sensitivity. Psychic is basically extremely sensitive emotion with not a lot of defense mechanisms, if you want. So everything sort of streams into your feelings. So it can also be somebody who's very psychic. Again, I'm not judging if it's good or bad to be psychic. It's just somebody who's got that sensitivity. It's also somebody who would feel very good when they're not here. So there's lots of different ways to do that. You know, some people do now. It happens to be that the Moon Neptune, I'm just showing this as an example, happens to be one of the signatures of people who are phenomenal dancers. It happens to be one of the signatures for dancing. Because music belongs, as you could imagine, belongs very much to Neptune. It's that, again, that diaphanous, subtle, watery language. So one of the things you can do, now we're talking about the therapeutic aspect of what I do, is if somebody comes in and I hint at the fact that I ask them, you know, I don't say, hey, you're a junkie, but I ask them, have you ever had an issue with some kind of substance abuse? And sometimes it's shopaholics, sometimes it's sexaholics, it's just something to step out. Usually, though, it's some kind of a drug. And 19 out of 20 times it's accurate, and people are like, oh, how do you know that? Well, it's a signature. And once you start thinking the way we're thinking tonight, it's not that strange that you would be able to see that in a chart. But the key question is here, how do you know if someone's a dancer or a junkie? And the answer to that is you don't. Now, some astrologers will say, well, I can tell. I don't believe you can, because now we're talking about a different thing. We're talking about choice. We're talking about free will. And we're talking about a different level. And this is where some people stumble with astrology because they think it's all fatalistic and it's all predetermined and we don't have free will. Free will is a huge part. I want to give you an example. A wonderful story. This is one of my favorite stories of how and why astrology works. I had a client a few years ago who moved to the United States from a foreign country because her husband tried to kill her twice, and this was a European country. And so she ran away, basically escaped with her life. She's an artist, very talented artist. She showed me some of her artwork. It was really amazing, very sensitive, very sort of Neptunian. Now we can use that word. And she found a roommate in L.A. who turned out to be psychotic and attacked her with a 10-inch chef's knife. Didn't hurt her. She ran away from that, too. But pretty strong symbolism there. Then she had many other horror stories. She'd been raped. She had lost her son, not literally, but her ex-husband kept the son and wouldn't let her see him, turned him against her, so she suffered tremendously from this young man who was, you know, a teenager and you know, talked to her like that. So I was, of course, curious, because when you think archetypal and you think in archetypal language, then everything is a symbol. And it just so happens that all the things that she's mentioning belongs to one guy, Mars. These are all martial symbols. If you look up Mars symbolism, you see knives, you see guns, you see aggression, you see violence, you see rape. You see Mars gone bad. She had experienced Mars gone bad intensely in her life. So I was very curious about her Mars. It turns out that her Mars was indeed the focus of her chart. And so I started to talk to her about rethinking her Mars. And this is now one of the key things of how I practice astrology, and I really hope you get that, and I will have a break, because I know we need pee breaks and stuff, and your brain starts going crazy. So, let's take raw Mars. Let's take Mars out of anybody's chart. We'll just talk about Mars. Not in that context, just Mars as an archetype, as a person. Mars appears in the world, as all planets do, on a continuum, on a scale. One end of the scale, you'll find Mars as a hoodlum with a machine gun mowing down 20 people in a diner. When I see something like that in the news, my first thought is, as I said, Pluto there, is like, there goes Mars, raw Mars gone berserk. That's one way of Mars expressing raw martial energy. The other end of the scale, same planet, same archetype, is a 10th black belt martial artist. The word martial, by the way, comes from Mars. Now, there are luckily very few murderers and very few, not luckily, but there are also very few 10th black belt martial artists, a handful. So, what you see is that the extremes are rather rare. And everybody in here, each one of you, the Mars that is in you, through all the conditioning, all the parenting, all the genetics, all the whatever, all the other factors are that make the Mars whoever the Mars now is as we sit here right now, that Mars appears somewhere on that scale. Probably not at the two extremes. But if you find that your life is awfully similar to that woman's, my client's, if you find you're constantly being pushed around, slapped around, anger, people around you are always angry, you're always angry, violence seems to be, you seem to be a magnet for violence or whatever, Mars may be a little bit too much to this side of the scale, and that may not be very beneficial to you. Once you start seeing a pattern like that, and this goes for any other planets, now you have a choice. This is where free will comes in. Now you could say, okay, I don't like this particular way that Mars is going. I want to change this. And what I did with this woman is I suggested her, I said, you know what, it's time for you to focus on Mars a little bit. I think Mars wants to talk to you. And I don't think you're listening. So it's not very comfortable for you. And I'm sorry I had all these horrible experiences. Let's talk about good Mars. So she, you know, for 6 months or so, she did a couple of different things. She started taking martial arts, which I think is one of the most wonderful ways to do, you know, good Mars. And if you're, you know, beyond the age where you think you can kick and so forth, you can always do Tai Chi, which is sort of the most spiritual form of martial arts. She wore a lot of red clothes, which is a Mars color. She did a couple of other things like that. So she started to sort of focus on this Mars rather than, you know, Jung had a thing over his door, that the gods will enter, invited or not. I've kind of turned that a little bit and I call it, you do the gods or the gods do you. And this is an example how this woman was being done by Mars in the worst way. So, 6 months after her reading, she keeps in touch, she keeps sending me emails and tells me what's going on. She falls in love with a cop. Now, I told you she's an artist. Now, she said, the only time I'd ever talked to a cop was, I'm sorry, sir, I didn't know I was going that fast. It's the only time she'd ever had any conversation with a police officer. She falls in love with him. To make a long story short, it doesn't work out, but through him, she gets into this whole new world that she'd never, through love, Venus, opener. She gets into this whole new world. He introduces her to these, you know, this brotherhood, this macho, all this whole stuff that were ways of Mars that are, you know, within certain okayness, I would say. And then, I qualified that. But it's new to her. She doesn't understand it, but she's interested. She's intrigued. To make a long story short, because of her background and because of whatever, she's in California, and there's a law in California that in every police station there's a domestic violence counselor. She got a job as a domestic violence counselor in California and did phenomenally. Before she knew it, within 3 months, she was training sheriffs on how to deal with domestic violence. She was amazing. So what she had done was she had externalized Mars. Mars was still the main player in her life every day. She saw all kinds of horrors. But it wasn't pointed at her. It wasn't, that arrow was pointed away from her. This is an example of how choice, free will, and astrology in a psychological context can change someone's life dramatically. It's one example of thousands that I could tell you. But it's a nice one. It's so three-dimensional. Sometimes it's more subtle. But this is, to me, a great story. And it changed her life. And she got a new sense of what Mars could really be. And she feels empowered. Another funny little detail, at one point, all the cops in the station were making fun of her because she was the only one in the station who didn't know how to shoot a gun. So they said, you need to learn how to shoot a gun. And they sort of challenged her. She said, well, I don't do guns. I'm an artist, blah, blah. Well, you know, they pushed her long enough that she finally went out to the shooting range. She was such a good shot, having never held a gun in her hand, that the trainer told her she should be taking a sharpshooting course because she was a natural. He just said, she had a good Mars if she was, you know, not how she wanted to use Mars, but that's one way you can use Mars. If you have a good Mars meaning a Mars you can apply, then, you know, you can be a good shot. As one way. But there's also a lot of other things. Mars is also your creative seed. Looks very phallic. It's the part of us that is the creative seed. It's how we create, how we spill our seed into fertile ground, those kind of things. That's also Mars. So if somebody says, I want to be more creative, I'm not creative enough, and I think I would be if only XYZ and my mother hadn't and all that stuff, once you get past that, then you could say, okay, let's put all that away and let's just look at your Mars. What does your Mars want? How is he dressed? Where in your life does he want to act? And now you've got something to work with that's rather specific. Okay? Because now you've got 12 times 12. Now you have 144 different kinds of Marses, right? Just doing the math. And that's even not looking at how Mars relates. But there's 12 houses and 12 signs. So there's 144 possibilities for that Mars to be just right off the bat without even having looked at how he's relating to other planets on the stage. Okay? You start to get a sense of how this works. Now, another interesting piece. By the way, if anybody has a question anytime, I don't mind at all being interrupted. I do not lose my train of thought usually. And if I do, I'll blame you. So, yes. Yes, and now you're talking a little bit above those who don't know astrology, but there's lots of different ways. Again, let's stick to the planets. How that moon Neptune shows up in a chart, there are lots of different ways. It's not just the moon and Neptune. You could have moon in Pisces that's very strong. You could have the moon in the 12th house. You could have Pisces in the 4th house. Lots of other ways. We don't have to get into that. That's way beyond what we're talking about. It's just that those two archetypes, when they're interacting, that pattern erupts as a possibility. That's the need, the archetypal need that exists. That's the hole that wants to be filled with something, with some kind of behavior. And so it does. And most people aren't conscious, and so the easiest way, again, the gods like to do you more than you like to do them, because it takes effort, consciousness, and work to do the gods. And what happens is that I think of the planets sometimes as kids. You know, there are 10 kids in a room. So if you've got one kid, you can't tell one kid, I don't like you, you can't play, go to the kitchen, because they'll break all your dishes. And even if it's not Mars, even if it's Venus, you know, she'll go stab someone in the back, you know. So you have to deal, everybody in here has to deal with all their 10 planets. It's a very sophisticated language, but you have to know what these characters are and what they want from you, because they'll come on the door like this with a feather. Most of us don't hear that. And then it's a little louder, and we all have heard these metaphors, and then it gets a little louder, and finally they break the door down till you pay attention. So it just gets more intense if you don't pay attention to them. They are doing you because all they want is attention. I think of them again as kids. So now you got 10 actors, and each one of them just wants to be heard. Each actor on the stage wants a speaking part. Not all at once, please, but different phases, different times of life. And now we get into other things that astrology can do, like looking at what's going on right now in your life and not just the birth chart, all those things. It's all the same thing. We're trying to find out a time. Now is a time for Mars to speak in your life, let's say. Shakespeare spoke of the seven ages of man, which is kind of that same idea, that there's seven different ages. The first one is the puking infant. That's the lunar phase. And then you have the mercurial one, where you're learning in school. Then you have the Venus phase, where you become a lover. Then you become a warrior. And these kind of, he had that same kind of notion in one of his plays. So we have that for every time there's a season, it says in Ecclesiastics in the Bible. So there's this idea that different planets happen, at different times in your life. So you can't always just say, okay, I think I want to do Mars now. That may not work, because Mars may be having a really good nap and you just want to leave him alone. And if Mars is really active, you may want to deal with Mars right then. So that's another thing. You might want to know which planets need to be heard at this time in your life. But ideally, we want to find a speaking part for all of them so that we've made a choice. Or if they are expressing themselves in your life, and let's say you're already a martial artist and you like that part of you, and whenever you get angry, you know to punch a bag and not your kid, okay? If you've dealt with Mars in that way, then Mars doesn't need another speaking part. You've found a way to do Mars in your life. But a lot of people have a lot of unexpressed or unconscious planets. Jung once said, actually I have the quote here because I just found it today, I want to quote him exactly. When an inner situation is not made conscious, it appears outside as fate. Okay? This is exactly what I'm talking about. When an inner situation is not made conscious, let's say a situation like this, it appears in the outside as fate. Think of my client, inner Mars, very strong. She has no idea what to do with it because her surrounding or because she was a woman or because whatever she does, she suppresses Mars, and Mars shows up in her life in her face in the worst possible ways. As fate, if you want. If she didn't know this language, she might have said, well, I'm just fated to be a victim. Classical victim thinking. There's no such thing in astrology. There's no victim thinking. It's just, do you have an awareness of that archetype, or are you living it in a smart way? The problem is that once you know these things, you have to take on a huge amount of responsibility. I warn my clients of that. You can no longer play the blame psychology game. It's nobody's fault. Yes, it may be that some of your parents helped, or maybe you had. I have a nephew. His dad is really macho and really into football and was Mr., Missouri over 50 and those kind of things, So he's a macho kind of a guy, and his son likes to put on makeup and is very, it's wonderful to watch for me. Not very nice for the kid, but for me, because I see this other archetype coming up. So if his Mars is probably going to be pretty difficult for him to live in some way, because it's not coming out the way his daddy showed him how to do Mars. Hey, catch the ball, son, that's not his way. And so I told you there's 144 different ways to do Mars, at least. That's just for starters. So they don't jive. And if they don't jive, it becomes a little bit more difficult. So yeah, we can blame our parents for things like that. But once we learn and we know what these parts of us want, how they want to speak, how they want to be spoken to, how they want to express in their lives, hey, that's your ball game. So I really encourage free will and responsibility. A huge amount of responsibility comes with this knowledge, as it was with all ancient wisdoms. Once you learned this stuff, you took on a huge amount of responsibility. That's when you were initiated. That's why astrology was a sacred art, not for everybody, because the power of it was so much. You had a question.
So what if you don't have a planet in your chart?
Everybody has all planets. There's no such thing. Unless
your house.
That's a good question. Good question. There are 10 planets, 12 houses, so everybody in here has at least 2 empty houses, right? If I put one in every house, there's still 2 empty ones. Everybody follow that?
Yes.
Usually, you have more than one somewhere, or 2 or 3 or 4 somewhere. So very often, there's all kinds of houses. The chart may look almost like this, with a bunch of planets here. An empty house doesn't mean that that part of your life doesn't happen. Somebody looks at the chart, gee, my money house has no planets, that means I'm poor. No, wrong. Or I have nothing in my relationship house, that's why I'm going to be alone. No. It doesn't work like that. First of all, there's other ways, there's other techniques. That house still has rulership, as it's called. In other words, there's still lots of different complex ways to read a house that has no planets. But there is something important to learn here. You could see where a person's emphasis and learning really is. So if a person has 5 planets in the house of money, money is a big issue in their life. It doesn't mean they're going to have a lot or none. You can't see that. That's predicting. But you can make sure it's on their front burner all the time. If someone has nothing in the relationship house, it doesn't mean they're going to be alone. It's just as likely they're going to have a wonderful marriage for 50 years and never. It's not an issue for them. That part of their life works. They may have all the money problems, or they may have, you know what I'm saying? So it's just we all have our learning. And if we go at it with that approach, everybody's here to learn something. To me, everything in life is simply a lesson. I try to teach my kids that. I have two teenage daughters. It's scary. And, you know, they come home from school. Let's say somebody bullies my daughter. And it hasn't happened, but let's say someone does. My first reaction is, can I go and beat up that kid, please, and the parents? You know, I can't do that because I don't want to go to jail, and my Mars hopefully is a little bit more sophisticated than that. So I can't, but that's my first urge. But what I can do is I can teach my kids, since they were born, since they can talk, that there is value in learning. That I can teach them. What's called a teaching moment. Parents like that's a new sort of hot buzzword, teaching moment. I can use teaching moments as much as possible. Ooh, they bring something up. Let's teach that. Now, if they come home, we can sit down. We can say, okay, you've been bullied. I'm really sorry, and I really would like to go beat up the kid, but I can't. But here's what we're going to do. Let's talk about what you learn. Don't walk down the hallway alone with that kid. Turn, if you believe in that, turn your other cheek, you know, learn karate, whatever. There's lots of responses, but we can say this has now become a teaching moment. Now, since I have equated learning with value, now the event has value. And suddenly, my kid feels like, hey, there was something good in this. It has value. It wasn't comfortable. And you know what? That applies to the same thing here. Life isn't comfortable. There's no guarantees. Nothing is easy in that sense. But everything in a chart is a lesson. So I look at it that way. I ask myself when a client comes to me, so I apologize. What we're doing tonight is rather simple when it comes to astrology. I'm trying to make it tangible. It takes a lot of time to study astrology well. I tell my students 5 years before you can read a chart. Really, it's like a language. It is a language. So Mars in the culture is just one piece of what you're experiencing, John. There's other things. For instance, there's Saturn, which is the old guard. There's a lot of Saturn in our government right now. It's the old guard, the cronyism, old white men kind of a thing. You know, that's very Saturnian. Limits, rules, secrets, hidden stuff. That's all Saturn. So there's sort of a Saturn-Mars thing going on. There's also a lot of Pluto going on. You know, stealth stuff is also Pluto. You know, paranoia belongs to Pluto. Those kind of things are going on. There's also a lot of Neptune going on, misinformation, you know. Neptune-Mercury, the communicator. Mercury-Neptune combined is about lying and about telling fibs and about making things look a certain way and so forth. So it's you start seeing this the complexity. You can imagine how many thousands and thousands of articles have been written on the United States chart. This is a different school. What you're addressing is called mundane astrology, which is not a different school. It's a school of thought. It's a way of looking at the world and what goes on in the world through an astrological lens. You can do that with this. But what I'm trying to give you is a view of looking at people and how this expresses in people in the context of what you very well brought up, that of course there's always a cultural context to the complexity of what we're feeling. We also go through certain times when the two greatest revolutionary planets that there are, Uranus and Pluto, line up, which happens once every 100 years or so. We have major revolutions. Guess when the last one was? 1966. So you have this, people who study this, who write books about this, when these things happened. 9/11, Saturn-Pluto opposition, the two darkest planets fighting. Every time they're in tension, there's been a war, every single time in history. So there's people who study this and write about this. I have a link on my website to a wonderful article by Rick Tarnas on 9/11 about Saturn and Pluto and the archetypal expression of that in the culture. So this is a very interesting question, but it's really beyond what we're doing tonight. Maybe tomorrow we'll have a little time to look at that as we go into each planet more specifically. What I'm doing tomorrow, by the way, before I get to Connie's very important point of the calling thing, what I'm doing tomorrow is I'm going to look at each one of these in great depth with exercises, with guided imagery, with all kinds of different tools. We'll make things up on the fly. I'll give you whatever I've got to really understand these 10 planets very well. I'm currently writing a book doing exactly that. What happens if you have too much Mars in your life, like this woman's case? What happens if you have too little Mars in your life and everybody pushes you around and you don't know how to take a stand, which is a positive Mars thing? Yes?
We had a talk just in the break about the fact that there's also Venus among military officers.
Of course.
Sports
hugely,
figures,
hugely.
That's strong.
I once went to the military museum in Paris along those lines, and I looked at weapons from the 17th, 18th century. They were the most gorgeously carved, handmade, beautiful things of art. Objets d'art, no question. They were made by these soldiers. The most, so much love and beauty went into these weapons. It's absolutely there. Venus is in war, too. Of course, think of Helen of Troy. How many wars have been fought over love? Of course. All the archetypes are everywhere. It's complex. There's never just one. I took one out to describe it to you, but we can never see a chart independent of all this complex interaction. So, now I'm going to blame you because I lost my train of thought. Thank you. Yes. So I'm going to go into all of these 10 planets. So the question is, what happens when you have too much? What happens when you have too little? And what are the rituals that you can do to get more or to get in touch with this planet in a way that might be, that behooves you well, like the examples I gave to this woman with the Mars. There are things you can do for each planet. If you want to get in touch, if you want to dance with any one of these guys, there's things you can do. There's rituals. There's foods you can eat. I go that far. Why not? It's archetypal. It's everywhere. Okay? And yes?
I've heard several times in my lifetime, Mercury is in retrograde, don't sign contracts. Mm-hmm. Is that a generalization or is that specifically to...
I will diverge because it's Mercury. I'll diverge because Mercury likes to diverge. So I will. This is it's a little bit on the side, but I'll do it. Absolutely. Mercury, every planet except for the Sun and the Moon actually goes retrograde at times, which means, and this is hard to explain, I'm not going to try to, but just imagine that the planet, instead of moving like this across the sky, actually moves like this. It goes a little bit backwards and then forwards. The time when it goes backwards, it's called retrograde. You can't see it because the planets move slowly, but if you put a stick up, you know, in front of your house and you stood in the same place and you watch the planet, you will notice it goes past the stick, then it goes backwards again, and then it goes forwards a larger chunk. So they all go like this. Okay, some of them much more, some of them less. Details. Because Mercury is the god of communication, the part of us that has to do with talking, with trickery, with juggling, you know, clowns, with merchants interacting. The milestone, for instance, comes historically from people used to put stones down on the ground as an homage to Mercury in the old days, and so the stones became piles, and those became milestones in the Roman period. So there's an acknowledgement of Mercury being the communicator of the gods. He's the messenger. He has winged feet and the Pegasus hat and his staff, and he does all this stuff. But he's also a trickster, and he rules thieves. I mean, he's the patron of thieves and liars and all those things.
So if your house is, or if you're in a different place than someone else has delivered that message, it doesn't matter. It's a general...
No, now let me ask you a question, because okay. I just wanted to explain what Mercury is archetypally. Now, it has been observed that when Mercury is going backwards during those periods, which happens about 3 times a year for approximately 2 to 3 weeks, that during those weeks, during that period, communication is messed up. That's sort of the traditional view, because there's a miscommunication. And the way I describe it is I talk about, imagine, again, we go back to our simple metaphor, actors on a stage. Imagine if I'm coming towards you, or imagine if I'm going away from you. If I'm a trickster already and I'm backing up from you, I would say beware, okay? Because who knows what I'm up to, what I'm going to do next, what I'm going to pull out of my pocket, what I'm going to do crazy tricks on you. So to me, it's an exaggeration of what Mercury already does, which is playing around. It's like a joke to Mercury. Everything's kind of a joke. If you know the mythology of Mercury's birth, there's wonderful stories. He thinks it's funny, you know? And he steals the cows, and then he actually makes them walk backwards to fool Apollo when he steals his herd. Because Apollo thinks, oh, they went this way, but he actually makes them walk backwards. So it's another simple... So what I'm saying is it true or not? What I believe is that I've observed a little bit. I was really never very interested in Mercury retrograde. It's not something that I was really taught a lot when I learned astrology. It wasn't that big of a deal in Europe where I studied it. And then I had a friend write a book. And she asked me to write a blurb, so I read the book. And it's an excellent book on Mercury retrograde. I highly recommend it. Her name is Pythia Pay, P-E-A-Y. She wrote Women Who Run with the Poodles. She's a takeoff on the... And she's a journalist. She's a journalist, and she's a really good writer. And she's not an astrologer, and she wrote a really good book for the general audience on Mercury retrograde. And I think it's a great book. So So she talked to him, and when I read it, she had so many examples were so good that I said, well, you know what, I'm going to start paying attention to see if it works for me. And since then, I've thought it's actually quite an interesting thing, and people ask me about it all the time, so I'm now paying attention to it a little bit more. But I don't, to me, it's just a matter of, it's a time when we need to, all the things that are retrograde. So we reflect, we retract, we rethink, we reexamine, we reevaluate. That's what's a nice thing to do then. So I always think positive. What should we be doing rather than what should we not be doing? So I'm not afraid of those times. I'm saying, okay, this is a great time to do X. I'm going to redecorate my office, or I'm going to redo these files. I'm going to do something where I have to reflect on what I've done. Okay?
As opposed to being caught.
Yeah, no, I'm not afraid of the planets. I'm not afraid of them. I live with them. You know, they're my friends. I mean, they're within me, and sometimes I hate their guts, but they're part of me. So you know, I live them. Okay, now I want to start getting to... Any other questions before we change gears here a little bit? I said before there are different kinds of astrologers. There's mundane astrologers. There are also financial astrologers. There are weather astrologers. There are all kinds of different astrologers. And my focus has been, I've done this now for 28 years, and my focus for the last 20 years or so have been on the issue of calling. My interest has really been, how do you know why you're here? Most people come and ask that question at some point in their lives. And so I started looking into this a long time ago and came up with a way to see it. It was almost not talked about when I started. There were one or two other astrologers who were looking into this, and there were some books, very little stuff. Today it's almost the hottest thing going. There's so many books out now on calling. And what I did was I teamed up with a therapist friend of mine. We co-wrote a book that's over there. By the way, if you want a book, I will sign it for if you want. They're $15. You can credit card, cash, or check, and it's fine. What we did was we opened sort of a practice together. We worked together, therapist and myself, and we documented about 110 cases that we worked on, sort of the proper way. She's a PhD, and she was a professor, and she did everything by the book. Then we took the best cases and basically wrote a book about what happens when a therapist and an astrologer work together. And they're mainly stories. But we also approached the practice, as we called it, through this lens of your life's calling. And there's a little bit of a metaphor that I want to introduce here that's important to understand, because there are lots of different views on what calling is. To some people, calling is, you know, where your heart is, where you're the most passionate, that's where your calling is, where you're the most comfortable and things like that. So I'm going to give you, instead of arguing what I don't think it is, I'm going to tell you what I think it is, and you can draw your own conclusions. I think it's an important question, because I think most people at some point ask themselves this question. So we start out with a philosophical context, which you may or may not believe in. Probably most people here believe in that. Doesn't matter. It works with or without. It's just easier to explain how I see it, which is the notion of reincarnation. I don't really care about other lives. Astrologers spend the whole reading on trying to tell you what you did in another life. I think that's kind of a waste of time. I think it's important to have some sense and, you know, where you're coming from. So I think now of the soul, which I will define, since there are lots of definitions of that out there too. Just for this purpose, let's define the soul as that part of us that travels through these many lives and carries the knowledge, the memories, and hopefully the wisdom of everything that you've learned in other times and places. Let's just pretend there's such a thing. And let's pretend the soul is traveling on an endless train track. It's coming from somewhere, going somewhere. Who knows where it's coming from? Who knows if it's nirvana, enlightenment, whatever. Whatever you believe, hell, heaven, whatever. Let's just say there is this endless train track and the soul is traveling on it. It's someplace on this train track. It breaks through a membrane and bursts forth into the body that you have when you're born. Travels with your body for a certain amount of time, breaks through a membrane again, moves on, leaves your body behind, and you die. It's a very simplistic view of life. But we are indeed here in linear time. We think in calendars, we think in quantitative linear time. That's how we function in this world. And this way of thinking allows us to explore these two places of interest to me, the place where you arrive and the place where your soul wants you to go. Your place of arrival, because you just brought everything in from other lives, whatever they were, is a place of great comfort to you. You don't have to do anything here. You already just brought it all in. There's nothing new here. It's like this is all your baggage. You brought it in, boom, here I am. Okay, this is what you already know. There's nothing new here. The other end of the piece of train track that becomes your life, this chunk of track, up here, this is the place of greatest fulfillment, because that's where your soul wants to go. So I see a dichotomy between comfort and fulfillment. Climbing Mount Everest is not comfortable, but could be very fulfilling. And this is where I differ from a lot of people who say that where you're the most comfortable, your heart opens up, all that stuff. I don't think that way. I think it is, that's the stuff that you already know. You're good at that, you're comfortable with that, but you're not fulfilled. When you do this up here, which is the most difficult, the most challenging, but also what you feel called to. I have this vision of sitting on a couch, you know, eating pints of ice cream, watching movies. That's fun for a couple of hours, and then it gets old and you have to get up and stretch. I think the soul has the same need. You know, show me something new. I'm here to learn something. Again, I see life as a lesson. So the ultimate lesson, if you want, is shown here by this calling, by this place. I see the calling as a place, not as a career description, not as a job you should be doing, not as a person you should fall in love with. It is a place in your life that you're supposed to explore. Again, we use a metaphor. If I tell you that your chart says that your purpose in life is to explore Paris, which is a place, you can respond by saying, I hate the French, I don't eat French fries, and they all stink, and I'm not going there. That's a choice. Or you can say, okay, I'm going to learn French, I'm going to walk the streets, it may take me more than one lifetime, but I will eat their food, I will go to the museums, I will fall in love in Paris in the spring, I will jump in the Seine a few times, and that's going to be what I do in this lifetime. Okay? That's a choice towards your calling. That's the ultimate choice that we have, is to go or not to go to our calling. This place, it is a description of a place, like I said. And when I say place, I mean that primarily it's a description of places shown astrologically by the houses. So the primary thing that this place that I'm talking about is the exploration of one of the houses. That's the primary learning. So if somebody has their purpose, their life purpose, their calling in the second house of money, guess what? That's what they're here to learn about on a deep level. Some, oh, I don't want to learn about money. That seems so boring. I'd like to be, you know, artistic. Well, fine. Learn how to make money with your art. And that's usually, and usually when you point out the calling to people, it is the biggest hot button because, of course, that's what they're learning. So they're very aware of it, and you can sort of tell how much work a person has done on that calling. Now, what you also find, and I'm going to do one more symbol here, because that's what the... This is the symbol of the calling. It's called the North Node of the Moon. And I'm not going to get into the why and history and all that stuff. That's not necessary. I'm postulating a theory here, which you don't have to accept, but I will tell you it's quite powerful. So let's say you have... what should we use for an example? Here. No, let's do this one. Sorry. No request. 1 and 7, okay? 1 and 7. Let's say someone has the North Node here, the symbol here, the 7th house, okay? We talked about the moon in the 7th house. By the way, that means if you turn this upside down, this is the South Node. This is where you start. That's just the opposite symbol. In my charts, you will never find the South Node. It's just always exactly across, and it clogs up my charts. You can always figure it out. Draw a straight line through, and you find the other one. So this would be the train. Comes in this way, okay? And is headed here, comes in here. This is now your comfort zone. This is where you're the most challenged, because that's what you really came here to learn. This is a person who, from a calling point of view, is very comfortable with themselves. Remember, this is the me, the I. Guess what happens when a relationship goes bad for this person? Guess what they say? I don't need you, get out of my life, I'm fine by myself. Classic line these people have said. You know, I don't need you because this is much too scary, this is much too much work. I'm very comfortable with myself. I don't really need to be in a relationship. What these people are here to learn is how to share. And not like my nephew said, another nephew who said, I know what sharing is, it means one of us doesn't get it. So not in that way.
These are darker.
Thanks. So not in that way, but in some much more mysterious, mystical, three-dimensional way, they are here to learn how to what I would call partner with someone else. to stay out of the marriage debate. So they're really here to learn how to unite with another person. What does that mean without losing yourself and all that stuff? They are learning about relationships. That's a theme. Now everybody here might say, yeah, that's me. Well, no, chances are, you know, one of 12 that it's you. But anyway, you know, doesn't mean others don't have issues with relationships, but it means that this is the calling for this person. This is a deep, lifelong learning. They're here to learn how to partner with other people. Now some people, that's not a calling. I want to be an artist. This is on a soul level. Now, can I just finish the thought and I'll get right to you? Now, of course you ask, well, what about the planets? And here's where we have a little more drawing, because there is a little train here. Okay? Despite 7 years of architecture school, I still can't draw. So, there's a little train here. And in the train, there's a dining car. And if you go to the dining car and you take the roof off the train track, off the dining car, and you look inside, and I am asking your greater imagination now, because we're staying sort of outside of the chart. We're looking at it as a bigger picture. Then inside the dining car of this train is Shakespeare's stage. The whole stage is in there. Now, we're not really looking at the... So imagine the whole thing is in this little train, okay? All those characters, all those parts of you are riding in the train from the south node to the north node. Okay? We can stay with that. That's the image. Now, we can talk about your personality, which is the sum total of all these parts. What's in the train is basically your personality. You know, who is Jack, you know, that's what's in the train. All these different, with all the needs and the anger and the love and all those things that make up your particular personality. We can talk about that person for, you know, 20 years and never ask the question, do these guys inside this little train have any idea that they're on a train track? That has to do with consciousness. That's a different question. Sometimes we get little things, hey, are you on track? You know, are you doing okay? Are you paying attention to where you're going? A lot of people say, I have no idea where my track is going. That's the ultimate question most of us at some point in life ask ourselves. This is a tool to see that very practically, very clearly. And I can tell you hundreds, if not thousands, of stories of how this works. To me, when you are working here, when I say working, I mean somebody with this chart, for instance, who is actively engaged in relationship stuff, including the heartbreak and the love and the marriage and the divorce and whatever it takes to learn this lesson, that's when they are the most deeply, blissfully satisfied, when they're doing that work. It doesn't mean it's happy. It doesn't mean it's easy. Remember about being bullied? Sometimes that's how life comes to us. But it is a lesson. The real ultimate lesson in life to me happens around the north node. Now you may say, now you're bringing up this very good question, what about free will and the node and so forth? Well, I think we have a lot of choice in how we live out what's going on inside the dining car. I think we have very little choice when it comes to our calling. I'd like to quote Jung here, who said, freedom is to do gladly that which we must. And to me, your north node is that which you must do. And until you do that, you're never going to feel sort of that you're doing your thing. People write to me, they say, I'm doing my thing, I'm blissful, I'm in the zone, whatever these expressions. We try to express it, but we know what it's like when we're there. But it's hard to express. That's what happens when you're living your north node. Now, this is an extremely simplistic description, again, because that's the only way I can explain something as complicated as a chart. And by the way, there's one other little piece here, that in the dining car, there's a speaker system. And there are voices coming out from the minute you're born, parents hanging over your crib, all the way up through to the old folks' home, people telling you what to do, what to believe, where to shop, who to vote for, you know, all these things. It's noisy. Some people call that the environment. That's usually what therapists call it. I call it the voices on the train. Okay? So if you're listening to these voices, you know, there are switches in this track. You can go one way or the other. Lots of times, sometimes three in a day, that could change your life. If you're listening to the voices that are coming out of the speaker system, that yakking, it's very easy to get sidetracked, off track, at times to backtrack, to stay with a train metaphor. So the key is to know where this is, and to that's why the book is called Alignments. To me, it's about realigning yourself with the train track that was there when you were born. When you came in, the train was on the track by definition of the metaphor. That's the imagery, that's the picture. Now, your question, again, about what about freedom and so forth. It's a very important question. I think because this is not a planet, remember it's just a place, Paris is going to be in the heart of France whether you go there and explore it or not. This place in your chart is going to sit there like a road sign. Hey, Jack, here's where you might want to go and dig. If Jack says, you know, screw that, I'm interested in over here, then it's not going to happen. So you have free will to explore that or not, but you can't really change the road sign in this case. Just like in some sense you can say, I can't change the planet. If you have a Mars that needs to be studied in this lifetime more than others, if Mars is the sort of the lead planet in a chart, as I said in the beginning, I explained that, if Mars is involved in the greatest tension, for instance, in a life, you know, as I said, the biggest noise is if Mars is there, then you're going to learn about Mars. You're going to learn about Mars probably the hard way, but it's a little easier to deal with planets that are sort of in tension than it is to deal with your calling. But when people hit their 30s, 40s, 50s, this starts becoming really loud. And it just gets louder and louder and louder. And that's the thing about hearkening your calling. And suddenly people, you know, drop everything and leave their family and go off, you know, to be a Buddhist monk or whatever. And they do these crazy things. What Jung called the midlife crisis. There's other ways to see the midlife crisis. But that's sometimes that happens because people are finally hearkening their calling. Again, a calling is not a job description. It's not, I'm called to be, you know, a fine art printer. That's not what it's about. It may be that you're called to learn about creativity, and the tool that you're using to do that based upon your personality that's riding the train is fine art printing, but the calling is to be creative. That's a calling. So again, there's so many different ways to do that particular one. And so then in a reading, I try to explore what the personality traits are. What are the talents? If somebody, you know, if somebody's 4 foot tall and their purpose in life is to be a sports person, or very active with their body, you know, chances that they'll be, you know, world famous in the NBA is probably nil. But they might do really well as a jockey. So you go with what the personality, what's there. You go with the material that's in the personality that we discussed in the first hour, and then you apply that all together to this calling, and then you have a very powerful tool. Because now you see what happens is that these guys in the train, what if there's an ego in here, shown usually by the sun, other ways too, but let's say by the sun, the sense of me. You know, the most famous sun statement, I think, that exists is by Louis XIV, the sun king, who said, l'état c'est moi, the state is me. You know, that's pretty sort of, you know. So the sun, that part of you. What if there's a sun on board that says, hey, guys, I know where we're going. We're going over there. I know how to run a train. I've done it many times. I'm a great train conductor, and we're going there. And, you know, the track is really going here. That happens. And we've got big sort of stuff to work out in the personality. So one of the tricks that we talk about in the practice is to let everybody on board know, all the parts of you know, that they're all on the same train. And they all have the same ticket in their hand. They're all really going the same place. That kind of helps. And then you can also see in a chart, and that's a very important next question, you can immediately see how your personality helps or hinders you to go here, to your calling. Because you can have, let's imagine for a minute, somebody has 6 planets over here out of 10. Every time you do a planet, which means you activate it, you live it, let's say you have Mars here and you're interested in yourself, you do self-exploration, whatever, you're sporty. Every time you do this stuff, you're not doing this stuff. A lot of planets on your south node where you begin, I compare to a big fat rubber band. Every time the train leaves, smack, it comes back to where you started. So it takes a lot of energy to move away from this kind of personality that keeps clinging onto what you already know and to go risk something new. On the other hand, somebody with 6 planets over here, every time they explore, every time they quote-unquote do relationships, because that's what they're anyway going to do, because they have a lot of energy there, as we said early, that's a part of their life that is busy, they're going to be doing their calling too. Is it better? Is it worse? No judgment. It's just different. Different lessons for different people. And to know that and to accept that and to embrace whatever it is, for me, one of the hardest things when people come in and they know just enough astrology to be upset about their chart. I hate my chart. You know? Then I really spend a lot of time trying to reframe that, because it's a waste of time. You know, it's not about hating or loving. It's about what are you going to do with it? You know, some people take lemons and they make lemon chiffon pie, and other people say, I don't like lemons, they're sour. You know, it's just a matter of, that's choice to me, yes.
The energy that you're speaking about, is that motivation? How are you motivated from the south to the north?
I think your soul's journey is outside of motivation. I think motivation is personality stuff. I think this is just the soul traveling and wandering through the lives, and this is the lesson for this time around. I'm curious in what people's lessons are. I really am interested in that. What are you here to learn? And how perhaps can my life interact with yours to make that learning happen? And guess what? The most powerful thing that exists when I do partnership readings is when two people who are together not only know each other's calling. I'm not going to use the word support. I'm going to use get out of the way for the other person to do their calling. And you know how often it is that someone who has this north node, the other person has this north node? Very common. You know, you're doing everything that I already know, and I'm doing everything you already know, and the attraction is enormous for about 7 seconds. I call that ships passing in the dark. You know, so, yes?
You mentioned that you were in architecture school for 6 or 7 years.
Yes.
Were you not knowing your calling yet?
No, actually I did. That's a good. No, it's a great question. I'd like to respond to that. In fact, I write about it in the book. I was 16. My mother was really interested in astrology. And I was, you know, good at school. I was bored. I wasn't doing much. She said, why don't you go study astrology? We have this family friend. He's been an astrologer for 40 years. He's a professional. Go learn with him. I'm like, okay, whatever, you know. So I did. I was 16. I get on my little moped. I go down the hill. I go to him. I sit with him. 10 minutes into the first reading, I had a total moment of clarity. This is what I'm going to do in my life. Just right there. A real moment of boom. Maybe it was deja vu. Who knows? And the second thought was, and I'll do it full time when I turn 40. And before then, I'll make, you know, a couple $1,000,000 and I'll retire on that and I'll just do it as a gift to the world. That was the second thought. Of course, the second part didn't happen. But the second part was I also wanted to do other things in life. So I did study with him for 5 years. I did open a practice after that. And I did it all through. I had all kinds of other careers and jobs. I have 3 degrees. I did all kinds of other things, but I was always doing it. For the last 8 years, I've done it full time. I started full time when I was 36, 37. So I'm 44 now, so it's been a while. So I didn't quite make it to 40 without doing it full time, but that was kind of the plan. So, no, I did know exactly what I wanted to do, but I had to do other things too, and I'm delighted now because from having done all these other things, I can talk to people about a lot of different things that I couldn't have before.
And at the same time, if you had gone totally into it, mm-hmm. you could have, through the depths of it, connected with...
I disagree. I disagree because I think the depth of life happens in life and not somewhere in a theory. It's the thing about those who do, and those who don't do, teach. You know, it's that also thing. So I think it's great that I've worked, that I've done stuff. I taught real estate for many years. I was a very well-liked real estate teacher. You know, saw the movie Wipe On, Wipe Off? That's where I learned. It's a movie. It's that symbolism is that you do something a long time. And then this was this kid who was learning how to do karate, and his master told him to wipe his fence on and off. And he's like, why am I doing this? And then the guy attacked him, and he did the same movement. He's like, oh, that's why I'm doing it. So to me, that's where I learned how to teach, how to stand up in front of a crowd and teach, doing real estate. So you learn other things. I learned about people who actually work, who don't just sit and have ideas. I learned about, you know, I have kids. I'm in the real world. I know about things like that. I'm married. I have a life. And so I know about people's situations more than I think it would be really difficult for me to talk to parents if I didn't have kids. It would be really difficult. I have a really hard time with therapists who do marriage counseling and have never been married. To me, that's very difficult. I think that's sort of miss, and that's just maybe me because I'm very earthy, and to me it's all about what's practical and tangible and useful. And otherwise, to me, it becomes too what I would call woo-woo. One of the things about astrology to me is that it slices through a lot of the other stuff, you know, that goes on. Because I sometimes tell therapists, I have a lot of therapist clients, and I tell them, you know, when you come and see me, it's like going to therapy for 6 months in 1 hour. And they go, oh, you're right. And then they come back and say, you know what, it's true. Because I don't have to ask the history of the parents. I don't have to spend week after week talking about this because it's already there. And it's not that, ooh, I got this crystal ball. It's already there. There's not the tension. There's not some of that stuff. There's this third thing that's neutral. The charge, you can't argue with. It's just there. It's like an x-ray to me. You can't argue with your x-ray. So it's there, and now something can happen out of that, and you can sort of fast forward. I'm not negating the importance of dreaming and of sleeping and of letting things work and so forth. I see myself as a seed planter. when I worked with the therapist, the whole idea was that I plant the seed, I do the reading, she works with them. I'm not a therapist. She holds their feet to the fire. You know, everybody comes out of the reading feeling great. 2 months, two hours later, the cell phone goes off and the beeper and the kids come home and it's all gone. And maybe 2 weeks later, they say, gee, I lost something. They listen to the tape again. Comes back, excuse me, for another hour. They have a lovely dream. The next day, it's all gone again. So that's where the consecutive work, I think, is very important. And I work with a lot of therapists doing, excuse me, I see myself there a lot as a radiologist. I do the x-ray. They're the doctor. They do the work. So the imagery is provided as a beginning, as a start. It's planting seeds. And you never know. People come back 6 months later, and they had a client come in the other day. I hadn't seen her for 6 years. And she said, you know what? Coming here, she came for a partnership reading with her new boyfriend, and she said, you know, coming in here, I listened to the tape, and I finally got it. Now I understood everything that you talked about 6 years ago. I had no idea what you were talking about then, but now I got it. So that's kind of cool when the stuff works over such a long period of time. I had a guy call me the other day that I did a reading for, a psychiatrist in Ohio, and I remember his chart, and I read for him 21 years ago in Switzerland. It was at the Jung Institute there. Somehow he found me. Somehow he found my book. He read it, and we had a wonderful reconnection. And he remembered the stuff. It changed his life in 1 hour. Actually, in those days, I used to do three-hour readings. I was still crazy and idealistic. So it's a very powerful tool. And it's the instrument. Anybody in here can learn astrology. It's not woo-woo. It's not, I'm not a psychic. It's a skill. It's a language. You know, if you and I are sitting in a subway, and there's a Japanese gentleman sitting across from us reading a Japanese newspaper, you know, he's looking at it, he's laughing, he's crying, he's getting all kinds of stuff. You and I look at it, it's a bunch of symbols. It doesn't mean anything. I look at a chart, I laugh, I cry, I see stuff, I see a story. Because I've learned how to read that language. And you can too. It's a language, just like you can learn Japanese. So it's a powerful tool. It takes some time, it takes a lot of patience and dedication, but it can be learned. It's not woo-woo stuff.
Connected with my question, mm-hmm. a little addition.
Mm-hmm.
How come, I'm talking to you as an astrologer, mm-hmm. how come there are people who know the calling right away, at 2 years old, 3 years, like my sister? And people like me don't.
That's a great question, and actually we address it in the book. Here's what I say. I say there's three ways to find your calling. The first one is people who know in their heart. They wake up one day, they're 2 years. I have a cousin like that. She was 5 years old. I want to be a veterinary. She was the youngest veterinarian in Switzerland, a 22 doctor. You know, just that was her thing. She's done it all her life. There are people like that. It's really frustrating for those of us who don't have that moment. Very frustrating. The second way is to pay attention to your dreams and your calamities and synchronicities. It's a really good way to be sort of be slapped in the face and say, hey, maybe you're off track here. That's the second way to do it. And some people change out of that. You know, they have a major calamity in their life, a major dream. You talk to people who've had those things, you know, breakthrough dream, suddenly I saw it, you know, I had a vision, whatever. People have this. That's the second way to do it. And in my mind, for those who get neither of the three, that's what I do. That's what the North Node is about. It can show you that. I tell you, this is my framework. It is not the Holy Grail. It's not the only truth. It's one way that works for some people. So
I totally resonate with the second one.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I survived a tsunami a few times.
Uh-huh.
And since then, I see synchronicities everywhere.
Right.
And my life is totally changing
right
now. But there, not right away, right. 6 months after.
Right.
The
lady had to wait 6 months to meet the cop. You know, sometimes it takes a while.
I mean,
right. Those are to me, I don't know of any other than those three ways that people find their calling.
The third one?
The third one is the node here. Yeah, which anybody can do, and it's a mapping, you know. So that there are these three ways to me. And if somebody is blessed enough to find it, you know, when they're five, more power to them. I feel fortunate because I had that thing when I was 16. But not everybody has it, and I understand that. Yes?
Is it redundant to do number two and number three?
If you have number one, I don't know.
Is it redundant to do number two and three?
If you have
synchronicity and to also have a charge.
That's up to you. I can't answer that for you. I like to have, you know, lots of different ideas about the same thing. Other questions? Yes.
Well, isn't there a lot? You say it's very matter of fact. It's not woo-woo, but isn't there a lot in this via the interpretation of how the placement of the north or the south node and the story that goes with it?
Absolutely. Let me define woo-woo, because that's important. No, absolutely. You're right. Absolutely. There's nothing woo-woo in the sense that you don't have to be psychic to learn this, that I can teach you this. This is a technique. It is a language, just like learning Japanese. Okay. Of course, the interpretation, guess what? You and I read a poem, be it in English or in Japanese, we have a very different way of interpreting. Of course it matters. Of course there's chemistry going on between me and the client. Of course some clients, it's fantastic. I hit it off like that with them. Of course, and others, I wish the time would go by. Of course that happens. That's human nature. Of course. That happens in any therapy session, that happens in any interaction between two people. One advantage that I have with the charge is that I do have this third thing that's kind of objective and tells me if I'm way off or way up, you know, or on. It's like the doctor who has the x-ray, you know, if they think you've got cancer or maybe not, depending if they like you or not, they do have something else they can look at. And that's kind of helpful. So it's a tool that keeps me objective on some level. The more I read, the less I use the chart. There is definitely a trained, intuitive, whatever, component to it as you learn it more, just like anything else. Just like if you write a lot, you become a better writer. You learn some of the skills. You don't have to do your outlines anymore. Maybe you can write it directly and almost write it cleanly, you know, maybe. So, of course it has to do with me, and of course there is that. And there are a lot of astrologers out there that say things that I cringe from. Of course, there's bad apples in every profession, of course. And I've had people come to me and say, my astrologer said I would be and my kid would, and you know, all these things and all this prediction stuff. I don't predict. I talk. Excuse me?
I have a good
astrologer. Right. And so that's good. Of course it matters who is interpreting. And everybody should, in my mind, have somebody who can explain these things in a language that works for them. And I'm certainly not the astrologer for everybody, and neither is yours for everybody. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't work that way. There's a lot of different kinds of approaching it. But the main idea, I think, it's important. Some of the philosophical questions are important. Like, do you think you have free will or not? A lot of astrologers don't believe that, who think it's all predetermined, it's just a matter of them to tell you what's going to happen to you. I find that very presumptuous and disturbing. I take for free anybody who has been what I call damaged by an astrologer. I don't charge for that. Because it's part of the professional thing for me that, you know, to set that right. And I've had people who were terrified, but their friend talked them into it. And I had one woman, I remember in Georgia, who was just terrified of what her astrologer told her about her son and this and that and the other, and she was a wreck. And I worked with her, and then it's almost like taking a tape out of your head and putting a new tape in there, and the VCR plays a nicer film. You know? So, yes?
My question is, I started studying astrology. I haven't paid attention to it for a long time, but about 30 years ago, I spent a number of years learning about it, and I was amazed at how really accurate it was, how really it explained things, it made sense to me. But I've never understood why it should, in the sense that why should the placement of the planets at the moment I was born...
Thank you. It's a great question. May I respond? May I respond to that? I love that question. It's a very important question. I was going to start with that, but I'm glad we bring it in now, because if you get too theoretical, it's better to just jump right into the stage, I think. So let's talk about that now. The first thing to understand is notions of time. The Greeks had two different notions of time. One was Chronos and one was Kairos. Chronos is what where we have chronological from, and is basically linear time, pieces of time, bits of time. That's a chronological way of thinking, which is what the way most of our science has gone, because science deals with exactitudes of minutes and seconds and milliseconds. Kairos is the understanding of not how much time, not the quantity of time, but the quality of time. There's this notion that there are different kinds of time. This was completely part of the thinking in other eras of human consciousness. So you went to the oracle in Delphi and you said, is this the right time to do X, Y, or Z, become king, have a kid, start a city, whatever? So it's, you probably didn't go to ask about a kid. It was more the bigger things. But anyway, you went there for the idea of, is it the right time? Now, we still have that in our language. So it's somewhere still within us, because we say things like, this is a bad time. Are you having a good time is a qualitative in question. Or this is not a good time for me, or I'm having a bad time. Those are qualitative statements. We have some notion. But imagine if you're working with a partner somewhere in a firm and you say, you know what, we shouldn't sign this contract till Friday because it's a better time to sign it. They'd look at you like you're crazy. From a Kairos point of view, that makes perfect sense, because there are more harmonious times and other times. Remember, the planets are moving all the time in the sky. So as they're moving, they're forming these relationships. So at a time when Mars and Saturn are, you know, in a stiletto fight, under, you know, have their swords under each other's throat, it's probably not a good time to, I don't know, get married. Because that moment then would carry that tension in it, because the tension that's going on in the sky is also going on in the rest of the universe. And this brings up the important question. The core idea in astrology is that the universe is one. Everything is one. Most esoteric wisdoms say that. The Echad, the one, the unity, that kind of idea. Everything is part of that. You and I are, the world is, the planets, the animals, the stones, and also the planets. It's part of that one system. The most important misconception, so I'm going to first say what astrology isn't, because it's so much out there, just like sun sign isn't astrology. It is not a causal relationship. It is not that the planets are doing something to you. You are not a puppet on a string and Pluto is doing this and now your shoulder jerks because Pluto did something mean to you. It is not causal. Because that's the first thing, well, you think Pluto, you know, is doing something to you? No, I don't. I don't. That's why this whole thing about trying to find the rays and measuring the... That's all, you know, has nothing to do with it. Astrology is fundamentally... I hate to use that word in this context, but astrology is basically, in its core, a synchronistic language, which is right up Jung's alley. Which means that because the planets and your life, or let's say life on Earth in general, are part of the same system that we just said, part of this unity, when something happens here, synchronistically, the same thing happens here. They are only connected by meaning, not by any rays. The connection is a synchronistic, which I don't have to explain here to this group, but it's a synchronistic connection. So, when there is tension above, there is tension below, because it's happening within the same system. The whole system, it's the butterfly at one end of the thing, and you know that whole quantum physics thing. It's the same thing. So it is a connection by meaning. So if there is tension in the air, let's say, as I said before, I like that imagery where you have two planets, swords up under each other's throats. Okay, that's a moment in time. That lasts while these, let's say there's a fast one over here, a slow one over here, a fast one over here, he catches up, boom, they're in great tension. Across from each other in the circle is considered the greatest possible tension for two actors across the stage. They're facing off. Look at the language. Facing off. The second most tensional one is called squaring off. It's a square, 90 degrees from each other. So two planets, 180 degrees across from each other, is the greatest possible tension. That happens for a moment. The planets are moving different speeds. Boom, there we are for one day, let's say. Tremendous tension there. Things explode. Things happen. Again, the mundane astrologers look at this thing from a world point of view. My friend Ray Grassi wrote a book about the Aquarian Age, which we might have time tomorrow to talk about a little bit, and talked a lot. He collected data for 15 years about the symbolism of Uranus's transits through the Aquarian Age and so forth, and how that happens. The Challenger explosion, the Titanic movie, you know, came out. And the cycles of these things. There's a way to relate that to the world. I'm interested in people, so I'm more looking at that moment. Pythagoras said that when we're born, we are stamped like wax by the cosmos. I love that image. So it's almost like we're molded by that time, because as above, so below. That's one of the core tenets of astrology. Now, this is a belief. You either believe that or you say, that's humbug. At some point, astrology becomes a belief. I approached it. I have a very scientific background in my schooling. I approached it from an empirical point of view. Does this stuff work or not? Who cares about the theories? And when you do it long enough, you figure out it works. It really does work. And so when you see it works, then you start asking yourself, well, how does it work? And then I came to these answers that I'm giving to you now, that it's a synchronistic connection. It's not causal. So, and it boils down to that core tenet, as above, so below. And there's a second one that we use all the time, which is as inside, outside. If you're very tension inside, you're going to attract very tense people. We're all much more familiar with that. One of my favorite ones is in a restaurant. You can bank on it that if the waiter is really crabby, or the waitress, the owner is going to be the same way. I've seen that so many times, traveling all over the place. It's remarkable, almost. There's sort of this, you know, law of attraction, as we call it. Same thing. That's just another.